Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The third annual Bridging Religious Divides Symposium, Disrupting the Cycle of Genocide, was held recently in Salt Lake City. The symposium was hosted by Utah Global Diplomacy and Bellwether International. Today we're going to talk with Rachel Miner, founder and CEO of Bellwether International. It's an organization committed to disrupting the cycle of genocide and building genocide-resistant societies. We'll also be talking with Jenny Lloyd, board chair of Utah Global Diplomacy. So we welcome in Rachel Miner. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Jenny Lloyd, thank you for being here. Let me start with Jenny Lloyd. Tell me a little bit about Utah Global Diplomacy. What is that organization?
Yes, we've been around for nearly 60 years. We were founded by a woman named Taza Armstrong Pierce from Park City. And she had a desire to learn more about other nations and to welcome people from all over the world. And so she put together this organization and really provided a hosting service and an education opportunity for people. And so we're all about citizen diplomacy, soft diplomacy, and the belief that everyone can participate in shaping U.S. foreign relations one handshake at a time. And so we believe that everyone deserves respect and understanding, that the people of the world are interconnected, and that we all have a social responsibility and we need to maintain open dialogue. So that's pretty much the foundation of what we do.
All right. What's got you interested in this work?
What got me interested in this?
Yes.
Okay, so about 10 years ago, I heard about an opportunity. I attended a lecture, the World Affairs Symposium. And at that lecture, they were looking for dinner hosts, people to welcome as international delegations came through. They were looking for people that could host dinners in their homes. And I thought that sounded really fun. I have a background in international relations. And so we signed up, and in the past 10 years, we've had people from over 50 different nations come to our home. And it's been fascinating, people from the Mideast, from Africa, from Central Asia, and it's just been such a wonderful, enriching experience. And so I just became increasingly involved and just saw the power of it in my own life and wanted to really work to give other people that opportunity too.
Rachel Miner, tell me what Bellwether International is.
So the word bellwether means to be a leader or an indicator of trends. It has a financial meaning in markets. There's bellwether stocks, which if you watch the bellwethers, so goes those bellwether stocks, so goes the market. But it also has an older meaning in relationship to sheep herding. And in every flock of sheep, there's a lead sheep that has a bell tied around its neck. That sheep becomes the bellwether sheep. It leads the flock and helps it to know where to go. 7 years ago, I was thinking about the movement of human rights broadly, and the most serious human rights violation that exists in our world, which is genocide. There's nothing worse than genocide. It really represents the end of the spectrum. And all of my training is in economics, so I started to think about how do we create a bellwether movement to prevent genocide? It's such a distinct kind of violence. That's actually predictable. There are very clear early warning signs that genocide will take place. And for lots of forms of violence, you don't get a lot of lead time, but genocide takes years to really architect, which is both very dismal, but that's also where the hope lies. If it takes so long to desensitize a group to human rights and to human dignity, then we have some time to actually start thinking seriously about prevention. And that's what our mission is at Bellwether, to disrupt the cycle of genocide. It's a cycle. It's a trap. It's predictable. We can think about some of these early warning signs. And the second part of our mission is to create genocide resistance, to give every nation on earth the tools to actually become a part of a resistance movement so that when governments or institutions or even your own communities say, this is who we're going to scapegoat, this is who we're going to hate, everyday people have the ability to resist that hatred and say, no, I'm going to be a bellwether. I'm going to be a different kind of leader in my community.
Mm. So, Jenny Lloyd, I see a connection here, I guess, everybody's a citizen diplomat, right?
It
takes everybody to disrupt these cycles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I really appreciate what Rachel said about those early warning signs that So you talk global diplomacy, we're in the prevention lane here. We're trying to make sure that it never escalates and that we can avoid contempt and those things that are the warning signs.
And that's really where this partnership started. So 3 years ago, Bellwether was thinking about the global movement to prevent genocide and thinking about what the global local partnership should really look like. And Utah is a really amazing state, and I think Jenny can really speak to the Utah moment. But Bellwether's vision was, okay, if we're going to really equip not just the United States, but the world with the tools and the conversations and the resources to bridge divides, and in the unique context of Utah, bridge religious divides, bridge other divides across the state, then we have to be thinking like Bellwether. So we actually chose Utah Global Diplomacy 3 years ago as our local Utah partner to really carry out a program that equips people with the skills, a symposium that equips people with the skills. And then this year we brought in a Nobel Peace Prize winner who could really model what it looks like to be a bellwether in a real conflict. I mean, people hear the word genocide and they think, oh, it's inevitable. It's part of the human story. I'm here to tell you it's not. And Lima Gobi, the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize winner that we brought to our event, said the same thing. It's not inevitable. Violence is not something that we just have to submit to or be satisfied with. But she truly was a bellwether in Liberia. She stopped the civil war, she prevented a genocide. And she models what that looks like, not just for Utah, but for this broader conversation, for the global movement to prevent genocide. And for anyone who reads the news and is aware of what's happening in Israel, Palestine, in Sudan, in Asia, genocide is a contemporary issue. And it's easy to feel overwhelmed and to feel polarized. But with Utah Global Diplomacy, we're charting a different path, which is you can talk across differences and you can do it kindly and with respect. And you can become part of a global movement to protect human dignity, to prevent genocide, and really create the resistance that our world needs, I think, more than ever.
Give me some numbers. Sometimes when genocide is not in the, of course, it's often in the news. It is prevalent, but sometimes in a lull we think, well, it's not happening here, so it's not happening. Tell me some numbers.
So, just in my lifetime, we've seen seven US designated genocides. The State Department for the United States will make official designations and acknowledge where genocide is happening in the world. It's not always holistic, and of course, there's a process that makes the designation random. But right now, we're seeing genocide happen on average every 2.5, 3 years, and this is globally. Genocide is the deadliest conflict of the 21st century. It's killed more people than World War I and World War II combined. And it especially has been a tool of violence that's affected religious people. Muslims and Jews are disproportionately victims of genocide, both from the Holocaust, but in terms of contemporary genocide, the Rohingya Muslims, the Uyghurs in China, Muslims in the Middle East are now disproportionately victims of mass atrocities. So I think, especially for religious people who care about human rights, we have to start thinking critically about preventing the worst outcome, about preventing genocide. And again, knowing that there are tools and there are very real ways to do this, not just from Liberia, not just from Lima Gobi, but one of my early mentors and friends is Malala Yousafzai and her family. And they've really modeled what it looks like to be bellwethers. I mean, if you look for the citizen diplomats, if you look for the bellwethers, if you look for the people that are actually out there doing this work, they don't always make the news, which is why I think this conversation is so important today. But you will find the bellwethers. And we have those case studies, we have the information and data to copy what they've done effectively, to follow in the footsteps of Martin Luther King and the other great leaders who have really led bellwether movements to prevent identity-based hatred, which is really the definition of genocide, and what ultimately starts as identity-based hatred and evolves into something far more serious.
Tell me about the cycle of genocide.
So we're seeing in our economic data that there are really three main drivers that cause genocide in the world today. One of the number one indicators that we look at comes from economic research around how countries get trapped in the cycle of genocide. So we know, for example, that countries that have experienced genocide in the past are three times more likely to have a genocide in the future. What this tells us is that genocide isn't random and it's not spontaneous, but it's actually affecting a smaller group of countries and it's affecting them over and over and over again. So let's talk about Sudan. This is the largest genocide in the world currently, the largest ongoing genocide. It's killed well over 200,000 people. It's displaced millions of Sudanese internally and outside of Sudan. It's not really in mainstream news cycles. And it's also not the first episode of genocide that we've seen. For a lot of listeners, you'll remember Darfur and a lot of the news in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, about a campaign to target an ethnic minority in Sudan. The group that is in power right now in Sudan basically rebranded from that time, launched a military coup, and have continued an identity-based campaign in Sudan. So it's part of this cycle. It's part of this trap. There are ways to help Sudan and now the neighboring countries. South Sudan is very much affected. Other countries in the region are affected. But we have to start by first understanding the nature of the problem, and then second, understanding how we actually disrupt. So going back just briefly to the point I mentioned earlier, we hear politicians say never again. And we also hear other people say, hatred is part of the human story. It's part of history. It's just going to keep happening. What we know based on research from Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, and Sierra Leone is that disruption and prevention is as much a part of human history as is the violence itself. So we know from those case studies that economic struggles, normally a period of economic suffering, is what directly precedes every episode of genocide. Even if you look at the Holocaust, there was a prolonged economic recession, a lot of volatility, and that actual economic vacuum is what Hitler used to then target the Jews. The first boycott against Jews was an economic boycott. Kristallnacht was about, we're not going to trade with Jews, we're not going to do business with Jews. So there is a very strong economic component to prevention that Bellwether is bringing to light for the first time. Largely, what we've done in the past for prevention efforts are legal measures. We need the law, but we also have to start thinking about these economic components, and that's where we're going to see effective prevention take place.
Jenny Lloyd, I want to bring this back to, you might say, well, the U.S. is not Sudan. Utah is not Sudan. But we know we do have in the U.S. and in Utah pretty serious divides and probably growing divides.
Yes, and that's what's so concerning because it's so easy to think, oh, that would never happen here. But I think Rachel can probably testify that it can happen anywhere. And so we just need to be so careful here in that prevention mode. But Utah leads the way in some remarkable areas. So Rachel talked about tools. We have the Dignity Index. We've got Braver Angels, which is a national organization, but with a strong chapter here locally. And then the Disagree Better campaign. And in all of those, I've been so drawn to those because they have very specific tools and ideas of ways that we can communicate that will help to lower the temperature and to get us out of this mode of contempt. And I think the Dignity Index is so interesting because they have this 8-point scale. And they talk about the different levels of communication. So level one, which sounds like the genocide level, is they're not even human. It's our moral duty to destroy them before they destroy us. And then at the top of the scale is each one of us is born with inherent worth. So we treat everyone with dignity no matter what. And that's what we're looking for is this dignity. And Lima talked about that so eloquently and beautifully about it, the war, or sorry, peace isn't the absence of war, but it's creating spaces of dignity for everyone. And that's what we're really striving to do.
And I'll just build on that by saying, Utah, the United States, a lot of countries in Europe, I think, are having their own reckoning with identity-based hatred, with the degradation of human dignity. And we also just have to think in terms of prevention, it's about upstream interventions, right? We don't want to wait for things to escalate further. The United States has its own history of mass atrocities and genocide against Native people. And we live with that knowledge. We live with the knowledge that actually we're a post-genocide nation. We're going to have to work extra hard and be extra vigilant in protecting human dignity, in overcoming identity-based hatred, and overcoming racism and other things that have been a challenge for not just Utah, but for the United States. And there are so many amazing leaders, I think, in Utah, as Jenny mentioned, that are really showing us what this looks like. It was interesting because when Lima started her remarks, she kind of painted a picture that I think a lot of Utahns really resonated with. She said, "Close your eyes, and I want you to imagine a world where you have your family, you have your home, you spend time together." She was very much, in a way, kind of painting a picture of what everyday life in Utah looks like. And then she said, "Imagine that in a moment that could be gone. And the very boys who grew up in your community, the ones you helped with your homework, are now standing in front of you with guns." I think the real myth around genocide and mass atrocities, the place where we get too comfortable is, as Jenny mentioned, that won't ever happen to us. That happens overseas. That can't happen here. It's a little bit like deadly disease in that way. We think of deadly disease affecting faraway places, but COVID-19 wasn't too long ago. I think we still have a memory of how quickly pandemics can affect places like Utah and other places in the United States. What Bellwether is trying to do is create an immunity against the deadly disease of genocide, but not just genocide itself, genocide ideology, the ideas that polarize us, the ideas that cause us, as Jenny said, to slide away from human dignity and towards a mindset that our neighbors, oh, we don't talk to them. They're part of this political party. Oh, we don't engage with them. They go to a different church. Oh, we're not interested in that group because fill in the blank. We're all susceptible to an ideology that will poison us, that will cause harm to our nation, to our community, to our state. So if we are vigilant as bellwethers, it's not just about imagining the worst outcomes. It's actually thinking about this kind of spectrum that leads up to mass atrocities, a spectrum that leads up to genocide, and thinking, how do we become part of the resistance movement? How do we immunize our families, our communities, our state, our nation against genocide ideology so that when economic hardship comes, and it will come, we are not susceptible to blaming, scapegoating, or hating specific groups of people during those difficult times? That's the temptation. When your pocketbook is hurting, when gas prices are high, that's when genocide ideology starts to take shape in every nation. So we have to be vigilant against that. And when people or campaigns or institutions say the economy's struggling, it's because of this group, fill in the blank, it's because of this group, we have the skills to be the bellwether and say, actually, I'm going to teach my children differently. And in times of economic hardship, I'm not going to teach them to hate. I'm going to teach them to work. I'm going to teach them to bridge divides. I'm going to teach them to be a citizen diplomat. And that is what the movement is about. That's what it looks like in the state of Utah. And that's what it looks like in Sudan. And eventually, Bellwether's vision is to create a world where every nation, where every state has genocide resistance measures. We've adopted the genocide prevention lens so that regardless of what you do, you're thinking about how to resist, how to immunize your society and friends against hatred, against the deadly disease of identity-based hatred.
What are some keys? We'll get into talking about what you want your bellwethers to do, but you talked about families. I guess it starts there. Parents teaching children, we don't do othering in our family, right? We don't do scapegoating. How do you expand from there?
Yeah, I'm gonna actually turn to Jenny because I think the project that they do with dinners is really important. So Jenny, you talk a little bit about that, and then I'll piggyback off of your comments.
Yeah, so I think there's so many opportunities right here in Utah right now to engage internationally. So, for example, there are an estimated 8,000 international students on our campuses throughout the state. There are, I think, over 60,000 refugees that have resettled here. So there's lots of opportunities to engage with the international community. And so we have these dinner hosting experiences. And so we're starting to work with campuses now to host international students. And those kinds of opportunities of just getting into the home of an American. And we know from 60 years of experience of home hosting that when people come from other countries and have dinner in the home of an American, it sounds so simple. It is really impactful and powerful and influential. And it's something that people remember. And I, you know, we could probably all look to our own experiences. I remember as a student in the Soviet Union in 1989, I spent a summer there. And the Ilyushin family in Moscow, Russia had me to dinner one night. And that was one of the most memorable experiences. And everything that I had heard about the Soviet Union, like it all just sort of melted away. And when you have these personal connections, I think you can look beyond headlines, you can get beyond fear, and you can say, okay, well, that's a perspective, but my own experience was very different from that. And I think if we can lower the temperature and just help our kids feel more peace and calm as we engage with people and have our own experiences, that we can form our own opinions and that we can really make a big difference. I think Lima is just such a stellar example of that for a citizen diplomat who just wanted to make the world a better place. And she really had no business in stepping into that arena in, you know, in as the sense that people would look at and think, oh, who is she? Why is she stepping in here? And yet she had this incredible power that wasn't based on manipulation or coercion, but just on influence. And it, wow, I mean, literally changed her nation.
And it started in such a humble way. I think this is the lesson, particularly for Utah, acknowledging our listeners. Lima said in her speech, she said, with 10 US dollars out of someone's handbag, we started a movement. It started as a prayer group. She brought some of her Christian community together and said, we need to pray to end this war. And when they realized that they needed to bring their prayer and action, a larger movement together, it was that $10 that allowed them to then convene more and more women together. She described in her speech, she said, from 7 women in a week, we had 16, then 240, then 1,500, then scores of women, 10,000 plus women standing up for peace in our nation. So when people ask me, okay, how do I join the Bellwether movement and what does this really look like? I think it's in Lima's words. You have to start where you are, number one. If you have $10 in your handbag, that's where you have to start. And it could be home hosting, it could be a dinner group. I want to touch on what Jenny said about refugees. Sudan actually isn't just far away on another continent. We have Sudanese refugees in Utah. We have Afghan refugees in Utah. We have more and more people who are coming to our state that have been directly affected by genocide. Genocide and the consequences are no longer issues that stay isolated in other parts of the world because of migration, because of globalization, because of international business, of which Utah is a bellwether in that regard. So we can't talk about this as far away. It's there. And so if you're going to join the bellwether movement, regardless of what your resources are, you start right here in Utah, thinking about how to help some of these communities and our neighbors, our backyards. And then as your bandwidth grows, so too does your opportunity to help in the movement. So if you feel like you can help your community and you're working in Utah as a bellwether and you're ready to think about the national stage, Bellwether runs a series of programs all over the nation. Most recently, we partnered with the World Affairs Council of America. We ran workshops in 10 different states to talk about what the Bellwether movement looks like, what the divides look like, how do we peacefully and respectfully talk about Israel-Palestine, how do we help, how do we work through that, how do we support Jews when anti-Semitism is on the rise, how do we support Muslims who are facing enormous hatred, right? The shooting that happened in San Diego just a day or two ago. I mean, these are the real issues that now we can think about on a national scale. Okay, my bandwidth has grown. Now you can join the international movement to resist genocide. There are very concrete ways to stand in solidarity with Sudan, with the Middle East, with other groups that are struggling overseas. And it really can grow based on your bandwidth. So if you're feeling something listening to this and you want to become part of the Bellwether movement to prevent genocide, you think about Lima and that $10 in their friend's handbag, and a group of women that went from 7 to 10,000 women. You grow in your influence and your capacity as your bandwidth grows. Don't run faster than you have strength. Be inspired about what it looks like at a local level first. And then, of course, you can reach out. There are lots of ways to become involved with Bellwether, to join our movement, to become part of our work in Utah and the discussions we have with Utah and all other states, wherever you are, wherever you're listening in, there's an opportunity to be part of genocide prevention.
Let's take a break. We'll come back much more on this discussion. We're talking about disrupting the cycle of genocide. And that was the subtitle of the third annual Bridging Religious Divide Symposium, which was held recently in Salt Lake City, sponsored by Bellwether International and Utah Global Diplomacy. We have Rachel Miner, CEO of Bellwether International, and Jenny Lloyd, Board Chair of Utah Global Diplomacy, with us today. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The third annual Bridging Religious Divide Symposium, Disrupting the Cycle of Genocide, was held recently in Salt Lake City. We're piggybacking off of that symposium. It was hosted by Utah Global Diplomacy and Bellwether International. We're talking with Rachel Miner, founder and CEO of Bellwether International, and with Jenny Lloyd, board chairman of Utah Global Diplomacy. Jenny Lloyd, I want to talk. Start with you this segment. You mentioned some initiatives in Utah, Dignity Index, the Association of Braver Angels, that's a national organization, Disagree Better, Governor Cox's initiative. There are others, I've heard people say, "Well, that's all well and good, right? Get along with each other." But if you really want to get your agenda done, you got to seize political power, and that'll get your agenda done. And a lot of times it seems like the raw political power just is more effective, which sometimes includes increasing divisions, not closing them.
Definitely. And I think that's probably true for the short term, but for the long term, where we want to, if we can keep our eyes down the road, I think it's so much better if we can figure out how to sit down together and build relationships, because it's really all about relationships. And I think that's the heart of what we do at Utah Global Diplomacy, is provide opportunities to form relationships that will have influence and staying power over the long term. So it's not always easy to see in the short term, but I truly believe it has a powerful impact over the long term. And I think we see that when we bring people in, and when we, one of the sayings I have in one of these groups is be curious, not furious. And I like that, because I think if we can be open to people and be open to why they're doing things differently, and not just assuming that we know why that's happening, but really ask questions and dig in and lean in, that I think we can have more meaningful conversations that will lead to better decisions in the political arena.
Can you give me maybe personal example of or those that you've observed? Give us a little bit of hope of being curious, not furious, right? And how that might have
being
worked.
Curious, not furious. Well, actually, maybe this is getting too personal, but as a foster parent, that was one thing that sometimes the kids would do things like, what on earth? Like, where did that come from? And the initial reaction is like, why, what are you doing that? Like, what, you're furious with them. And then when you step back and get their perspective and like, oh, okay, I had no idea, when you get the context for the decision, it makes a lot more sense. But so we actually, my husband and I, we were foster parents for orphaned refugee kids for a number of years. And that was such an eye-opening experience for us, to be able to understand where their decisions were coming from, because it was so different, because they'd grown up in such a different context. So I think when we can step back and look at the bigger picture, that understanding comes out of that, and unity, which is so powerful when we can act in unified ways, that's tremendous power. And I think going back to Lima, and she wrote a book about her experience, Mighty Be Our Powers. And I just love that title, because I think this idea of this mighty be our powers, as we come together in unity with a shared goal and seeing the connection that we have to each other, that those kinds of things bring such great power and much better decision making if we can take the fear out of it.
And it's going to
Yes.
require political action on some level. So, I mean, as part of our symposium, we shared a documentary called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Lima's group started by praying, and then they occupied a fish market on a very prominent through street in Liberia and started protesting with signs that said, "Mothers want peace. Time to come home. Put down your guns and come home." And then they didn't stop with protesting and peaceful protesting, mind you, along these busy streets. You could think about billboards in a US or Utah context should be part of how we, mass media campaigns is part of how we build peaceful protest campaigns. But they went a step further, and that was they went to where the political convenings were happening, and they organized political protest, peaceful protest, human rights. It requires you to organize. I think organizing a group of people is actually perhaps one of the most overlooked skills in democracy today. We have become so desensitized to having to leave our couches. We click on a few buttons, we have the world at our fingertips, we're engaging on social media. The democracy of the United States of America was not designed to be maintained through social media platforms. The Constitution was not designed to be protected by text messages and through the convenience of our fingers. It was designed to be protected through marching, protesting, sitting in peacefully, contacting your representatives, showing up in political spaces and saying, "Wait a minute, you represent us. Wait a minute, prevention and the global movement for peace requires the people who vote to do something. Democracy is so messy in this way. It requires so much of its people, and we forget that. Peace requires sacrifice." That's the story of Lima. The story of Lima is not peace came to us and we were able to sit back and kind of watch it come by. Peace took everything from her and her family. They sacrificed everything to give their children a better world, to give their posterity, to give their nation a better world. And we, because of modern conveniences, and I think for a long time because of safety and security, we have been separated from this law of sacrifice and what it really requires to maintain peace. In her speech, Lima talked about how peace is elusive unless we fight for it. And so I do think it does have to start small with your bandwidth and what you can do, but it does require something more. I am not going to give any kind of illusion that this is comfortable or easy or is going to come, like I said, through the ease of social media platforms. We will be required to put on our shoes and leave the house and maybe show up at a caucus meeting and maybe talk to a neighbor and maybe send a letter to a representative and a phone call. And on social media. I mean, this is the sacrifice that we make for peace. And of course, it's worth it because peace gives us everything that is beautiful about life. And it gives us a place for our children to play outside and to enjoy the beauty and majesty of the earth and all that we've been blessed with in the state of Utah and the United States and in the world. But I think really overcoming that kind of comfort barrier is what Bellwether is trying to equip people all over the world with. Sometimes overcoming that comfort barrier starts with your own trauma healing. Sometimes overcoming that comfort barrier starts with finding your village, finding a group of people that you can organize with. But we need to talk about this in realistic terms. You're going to have to do something that requires sacrifice, and it's going to make you feel uncomfortable, but of course it will be worth it. Democracy, peace, human rights, a world without genocide is what living is about. It is really how we achieve the greatest joy and the greatest blessings that I think this life has to offer.
Jenny Lloyd, I'd like to get your perspective on this that sacrifice, because your organization promotes the work of connection, right? What's your response to it?
Definitely. No, I and Rachel's totally right that we need to get out of our comfort zone because it's so easy just to to stay in our protected environments and to be comfortable with the people that we know, that we agree with. And so this idea of intentionally going into spaces that might be uncomfortable, where we have to lean in, get proximate, and listen, it's really important that we take that initiative. And there's so many ways to do that. We don't have to go far, but even just when you look at all the just the local news, the things that are happening here, like how can we have respectful dialogue when we don't disagree, when we don't agree on things? I just think it's so important to put ourselves in those positions where we will listen and ask questions and listen to understand, not just respond, but listen to truly understand. And Rachel, I just totally agree with that, that we have to be uncomfortable if we're really going to make a difference in this world. We have to get in
And
those spaces.
thankfully, we do have support. So I will say that one of the best ways to increase your bandwidth, if you're listening to this conversation and thinking, I can do more, okay, here's what it looks like. You can call Utah Global Diplomacy today and get on their list for dinner home hosting. You can reach out to Bellwether today and become part of our international initiatives, which support all of the things we've talked about: education, interfaith peace building work, trauma healing initiatives, economic development. Nonprofits are part of the infrastructure of peace, in addition to government work. So, if you're involved in your community and thinking I can do a little bit more, find a nonprofit that's part of this movement for peace and join them. The bellwether vision is that genocide prevention is a lens that we all adopt. Think back to maybe even 5, 10 years ago. When we talk about climate and the challenges of climate change and what's affecting our environment, more and more people in the United States, even this year, are reporting the strange volatility of shifting weather, right? Utah has a no-snow winter and then a very snowy spring. Parts of the US that should be really cold are burning hot. Other parts of the world are flooding, on fire. When we thought about climate 5 to 10 years ago, the problem felt so big that people didn't really know how to tackle the complexity. And so what ended up happening is that everyone adopted a climate-friendly lens to their work. Corporations started thinking and talking about sustainability. Governments started thinking about initiatives for infrastructure that's going to help reduce the effects of climate change. That is the vision for genocide prevention. It is as big and complex as climate change. But like climate change, not impossible to address. We have to adopt the lens of genocide prevention. We have to adopt a lens that says, I live in Utah and there are genocide survivors in my community. I'm going to reach out. Adopting the lens of saying, the United States is not immune to identity-based hatred. I'm going to join a movement to strengthen a democracy. Adopting a lens that says, we should care about our brothers and sisters in other nations, and I'm going to pair up with Bellwether in order to help the people in Sudan, the people in Ukraine, the people in the Middle East. And so that is what it looks like in practice. Use the existing infrastructure, use the nonprofits, and then bring that genocide prevention lens into your community, into your work, and become part of the movement through that lens. You don't have to shift away from the other things that matter to you. And certainly for some of our listeners, I'm not just giving you another to-do list on your ever-ending to-do list. I'm saying find where there are already good things happening in your bandwidth and in your sphere of influence. Bring the genocide prevention lens and find where it makes sense to intuitively extend that lens into where you're making a difference in your community, in the state, in the nation, in the world.
Let's take another break. We'll be back with the final segment with Rachel Miner, founder and CEO of Bellwether International, and Jenny Lloyd, board chair of Utah Global Diplomacy. You're listening to Access Utah. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Rachel Miner, founder and CEO of Bellwether International, and Jenny Lloyd, board chair of Utah Global Diplomacy. Just a brief final segment here. I want to focus on religion. That was the focus of the third annual Bridging Religious Divide Symposium held recently in Salt Lake City. Many divides, of course. I'll start with Jenny Lloyd on this one. Religion seems to be a big one, the big one. I guess that's where you're focusing on that in these symposia.
Yes, and supposing that was so, Lima's story was so fascinating because she united as a Christian woman with women of Muslim faith to bring about this movement. And I think the more that we can unite with other faiths and join in shared projects, we're going to see greater peace in our communities. Of course, here in Utah, we have that opportunity all around us all the time, and that's such an important piece. We are increasingly on the international stage here in Utah. Over and over again, I think as beautiful as Utah is and as wonderful it is, the greatest resource, it's the people. The people here are really remarkable. We lead out in the nation when we talk about the Utah way. And that's when we come together and work together for these common goods. You look at the next 10 years, we're having a significant moment on the international stage with the Salt Lake Temple open house. We'll bring tons of visitors from all around the world, and then preparing for the Olympics. And so as we bring together all of the attributes that we have, our different faiths, that we can create a welcoming space for everyone. And that's what we want, to be able to provide this peaceful society for our children going into the future. And that's going to require uniting with people with different beliefs and finding just focusing on that shared humanity and seeing people as individuals and not labeling them. So I think we're going to see some really good things in the future as we lean into this.
Richard Minor, what if you respond to that the religious divide, and then also I'm curious of some specifics on what you hope your bellwethers will do, what you're trained them to do.
Absolutely. We have an instance where Utah is a state with a majority religion. And this is what mirrors a lot of countries in the world. We have countries with majority religions and minority religions. This is where the religious divide is put to the test, and bridging the religious divide is put to the test. A lot of people think, oh, a way to make peace in the world is to make my religion as big and as powerful as possible. It is not unique to any faith. It's not unique to Christians, Muslims, or any group to think that there's one right way, that there's one truth that should prevail above other truths. But that is not the point of religion. Religion, is to share values, morals, and a view of the transcendent. It's a vehicle to worship a God and a power that's beyond yourself. So to actually artificially conflate a religion and to seek power and control over others is to kind of lose sight of what religion is for. It's to think about something beyond yourself. It's to anchor yourself beyond something that's just temporal power or control and mortality as we understand it. It's to aspire to the divine, to the celestial, to something spiritual, and to something that connects all of us, which is, in my own faith practice, a view that we have heavenly parents and that we're all part of a spiritual family. I think when we talk about the religious divide in Utah and in the world, and especially what we're seeing in the age of increased polarization, I just always have running through the top of my mind a quote by Pastor Martin Niemöller, which was shared during the Holocaust. He said, "First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists. I didn't speak out because I'm not a socialist. They came for the trade unionists. I didn't speak out. I'm not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." This is the ultimate test of religion and religious freedom. Your faith is only as strong as someone else's freedom to practice their faith. And the moment we see Christians defending Muslims with equal vitality and equal energy, which they bring to protecting their own faith, is the day we know that we have freedom. We have to adopt bridging the religious divide's vision that includes being so Christian that we protect Jews at all costs, being so Jewish that we protect Muslims at all cost, being so religious that we protect this freedom of religion at all costs, because that is when freedom will truly be realized. That's when we'll see the bridge being built, when we'll see genocide prevention, when we'll see a world that enjoys peace and liberty for all.
We're near the end of the conversation here. I just want to give each of you a chance to, tell people how to get connected, and suggestions of what people can do. So, Jenny Lloyd, how do people connect with Utah Global Diplomacy?
I think the best way is through our social media accounts because that's where we have the most timely information and all the events coming up. And we have a lot of opportunities that we can provide to people to engage with other belief systems and to hear about, to expose people to these international opportunities and to go deep, to go way beyond the headlines. So LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Utah Global Diplomacy, well, easy to find there. And then we'll provide links actually to sign up for our newsletter to know what's going on. And then, and to also sign up to be a home host if you're interested in hosting dinners or overnight stays for people that are coming to Utah. One event that I'd like to mention is the Dining Around. We have an annual Dining Around the World event. And this year, we're leaning into the America 250 celebration on July 5th. And this is a day that there will be community potlucks hosted all over the United States. And it's this idea of kind of a lazy Sunday afternoon, getting together with your neighbors and just sharing a meal together. And we really believe that we can change things, just one meal, one conversation, one handshake at a time. So that we'll be hosting one with Promise South Salt Lake at Fitz Park, but we would encourage people to either host their own potluck or go attend one and get to know your neighbors better and to engage with them, knowing that connection will help to bring more peace to our society.
Rachel Miner, how do people get connected with Bellwether International?
Our social media handle is the same across all of our platforms at Bellwether NGO, which stands for non-governmental organization, at Bellwether NGO. And we'd encourage you, as Jenny mentions, subscribe to our newsletter. You can find us online if you Google search Bellwether International, Bellwether Human Rights, Bellwether Genocide Prevention. Subscribe to our newsletter where we will share stories from genocide communities that bring hope and not despair. And we'll actually start giving you some of the specific toolkits that we make available. You can join our events in Utah and across the nation and become part of the Bellwether movement to prevent genocide.
Well, we've been talking with Jenny Lloyd, Board Chair of Utah Global Diplomacy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you
And
so much.
Rachel Miner, founder and CEO of Bellwether International. Thank you so much for the conversation. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.